And these women resented that so much. I mean, they forced them to do makeup classes and they all kind of rebelled. And
wait a second. Military makeup class? Is this what you're saying?
Right. Because
how fucking good can that really be? I mean, it's military makeup, like what the fuck?
War paint?
Yeah, right.
Hey, Warners, welcome to Women Your Mother Warned You About,
the podcast that makes business sexy again.
I'm Gina Tremarco, sales trainer and consultant at Pivot 10 Results and Carolina Improv Company.
And I'm Rachel Pitts, mommy, wifey, and mortgage loan officer with U.S. Mortgage. Gina, what's up?
Hey, wait a second. You're not just... You're more than what you just said. You said mortgage lender. Aren't you like the singing lender
now? I'm so much more than that. But, you know, yeah. I'm trying in this new year that we are, this new season, to not make it all about me as much. But yes, I have rebranded myself as the singing lender. And mostly because for the last 10 years or so, you know, I've been selling real estate. And now that I've shifted over to the mortgage side of the business, people are a little confused. Like, are you still selling real estate? Rachel on real estate, that brand makes people confused. So I came up with the singing lender since I've been doing those videos. So if you're curious about that, then find me on Facebook at the singing lender. And you can see some of those fun little parody videos I've been doing.
Fantastic. Yeah, I relate to people getting confused because Carolina Improv Company versus Pivot 10 Results. I still have people who are like, anybody who goes through Pivot 10 Results are like, do you still do that improv thing? I'm like, yeah, but I had to rebrand it because some of you were scared of improv.
Right.
So you can find me either place depending on what it is you want. Do you want to have a happy, energetic, laughing work environment, or do you want a little more conservative? You're still going to get goofy
the same.
No matter.
You're getting the same. We just come from different pathways.
We just have two different company names, so I get it. So, hey, today, super excited. We just interviewed Sarah Paticha, and I had to actually spell that out for myself so I could say it right. Sarah Paticha. Super cool. Once again, another cool woman that we could have talked to forever.
Yeah, I really enjoyed speaking with her, and I'm definitely, I look forward to reading her book that you have that is called West Point Woman. And I want to have further conversations with her. I'm going to find her. We're going to have lunch.
Yeah, she's super cool. And once again, she was brought to us by a rock star, Michelle Sirocco, who's been on our show with Televerde. And so really appreciate that Michelle gave us that connection to Sarah. So a little bit about Sarah before we jump into this interview. Sarah Paticha is an accomplished author, speaker, and consultant who has led cultural transformation initiatives for Fortune 100 and 200 companies and coached hundreds of leaders to higher levels of performance. A masterful storyteller, Sarah is a sought-after speaker on such topics as women in leadership, veteran employment, emotional intelligence. Dang it, I wanted to talk to her about that too. I forgot. Change, resilience, and leadership competency. Sarah's love of leadership began at West Point, where she learned personal accountability and leading by example. As a U.S. Army officer charged with leading over 300 soldiers on difficult missions. Oh, that could be its own episode that we can even get to.
I know.
That.
I think we should have her on again, honestly.
I know.
Sarah Paticha, part two.
She discovered that everything rises and falls on leadership. As a corporate consultant and leader for over 25 years, she has led initiatives in government, manufacturing, energy, financial, and healthcare organizations. She tackled complex issues with leadership solutions tailored to the client. Her efforts led to organizational transformation and greater profitability. She is super cool rock star that, you know, so early on is one of the first women to graduate from West Point. And I think she's just so inspiring. And I don't know, just her energy was really cool because you think military, you think militant, and she's just like this chill, laid back.
I thought
cool
my
woman.
Biggest takeaway from her is that my assumption of her actually knowing her was that you were going to get this real hardcore militant type of woman. And she actually defended her femininity a bit during this episode, which I think is great that you can be successful in a military environment as a woman and you can still be feminine. You don't have to shave your head and do the G.I. Jane bit. Like, I thought that was really powerful and a great piece of leadership for any women that are considering attending a university such as West Point and entering into the military.
And I think it's a great lesson overall. Just be who you are.
Right.
And be who you are and own that. And if you want to be feminine and pretty, be so. If you don't, be so. Just be who you are. I think that's another big lesson that we get out of this.
For sure.
So let's jump into this episode. And before we do, just a reminder, shout out to Dermavogue. Thank you so much for sponsoring our entire podcast. So let's jump into this episode with Sarah Paticha. Sarah, welcome to Women Your Mother Warned You About.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. We're so excited to have you because West Point Woman, that alone was pretty enticing. Like, we could probably just talk forever about that. But before we get into that, kind of want to break the ice a little bit because this is Women Your Mother Warned You About. To be on this show, we hope you think you're a woman your mother warned you about. So how would you describe yourself in your terms as a woman your mother warned you about?
Well, I guess I would say that I grew up with three brothers, so that had a big influence on me. And so I grew up climbing trees and competing with them in sports. And so I never really saw myself fitting into definitely feminine roles all the time. You know, I enjoyed that idea of having only brothers, and then West Point, you're surrounded pretty much by men, because at the time we only made up 10% of the Corps. And so I did find myself at times, even in my corporate experience, missing working for men, because sometimes I would work for women and I would see that difference. So I think when you've had a kind of a life experience like I have, it definitely influences you, how you see yourself as a woman. What you want to achieve. And I have always had a drive, maybe, that I haven't always seen in some of my counterparts. So sometimes I might be the woman that stood out and did things differently, maybe untraditionally. And sometimes you get feedback on that, like, why would you decide to do that, you know? And so I think you have to define yourself in the things that bring you joy, that bring you inner peace, and you know, go into the fact of the longing that you have to be more than you thought you could be, if that makes sense. So push the envelope, you know.
That's awesome. That's a different definition that we've never had. So thank you for that.
For sure. It's never a dull answer when we ask that question.
Well, just wait till we get to the question at the end.
Yes.
She's going to love that question. So you are a West Point woman, mm-hmm. author of, if you can see this, West Point Woman. And that alone really caught my attention. So I'd like to really jump into that. And you were one of the first women to graduate from the United States Leadership Academy. Mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome. I mean, that is dope. Like, I'm just going to say that.
Yeah, it was not easy. No, not at all.
So give us your perspective, starting with what made you want to go to West Point?
Well, there was a lot of factors. My parents were always encouraging us to go and get a college education. They valued education themselves. They both pursued PhDs. And you just have to understand kind of the dynamic in my family. My mother always had a profession. She pursued a higher education. And my dad encouraged that. And so I kind of had her as a model in a way that she didn't let other people define who she could be. So she got a PhD in physical education. My dad got a PhD in education. So that combination, you had sitting around the dinner table, my dad would ask me and my brothers, like mathematical questions that we had to figure out in our head. And my mom would encourage us all to be in sports, and she would play along with us. I grew up with a tennis racket in my hand, competing with my brothers. And she said every person should know how to swim. So we all had to take swim lessons from her. And she was tough grader, you know. We learned survival swimming even in as we were growing up. And so when they said, you're going to go to college, it just seemed like the next natural thing. But they also added, you're going to pay for it yourself. So all of us had jobs growing up. I had paper routes. If my brother had a paper route, then I could have a paper route. And Sunday papers are very heavy, by the way, you know, in Wisconsin, going up hills, you know, in my little bike and stuff, you know. And we did those kind of things. And my dad would make us take half of our income and put it away for college. And even with all that effort, I never really had enough for college, but they also required us to do very well in school. I can remember bringing home B's, and my dad said, you can do better. So there was this encouragement to be all you can be, even at that age. And we had moved to Massachusetts. My mother was a professor at Northeastern University, and my dad read like 6 newspapers a day. He was a continual reader. And he mentioned that West Point and the National Service Academies, of which there were 5, West Point, Naval, Air Force, Coast Guard, and Merchant Marine Academies were beginning to accept women. And he said to me that day, and I'll never forget it, his famous words, Sarah, it'll be a unique experience for a woman. And at the time, I really had done very well in high school, and I wanted to go to a good school, but I knew I didn't have money for an Ivy League school. And so I said, well, you know, I could always go up there and check it out. And so I went up to West Point because it was one of the closer ones at the time to where we lived. And I kind of fell in love with the place because they stood for something. They talked about service to country. They had an honor code, which was important to me. And I could tell from that, even that first meeting, that it was going to be very, very tough. And because we were escorted by upperclassmen, but I could see how they treated the plebes. And but there was something that kind of energized me at the same time. And in addition, I was a cross-country runner, and the coach was very interested in me. And that kind of made me feel like, yeah, this is something to consider. So I ended up applying to Army, Navy, and Air Force, and immediately got accepted at West Point. And that kind of was enough for me to say, okay, let's go there. So it was really a means to an end. And I think a lot of people are surprised that how many of the people that do end up at the academy, they did that for an education, but they end up doing something so phenomenal of serving your country, of having some of the greatest leadership experiences that you could possibly have by, you know, being in all parts of the world and doing things you never thought you would dream of when you're a little kid growing up in Wisconsin, like me, climbing trees, you know.
There's so much that people can for sure learn from any type of training like that, where there's so much discipline involved, that I'm sure you carried on into other aspects of your business. And so have you ever read any of those Pat Conroy books where it talks about, Pat Conroy did some books about the Citadel and the intense, hazing of the plebes. So did you go through any of that intense type of hazing? And do you think that it was worse because you were a woman?
Yes, there was hazing when I existed. Now, there's different definitions of hazing. We were not allowed to, where they could make you do stuff that would completely take away, like they couldn't hit us. They couldn't do things like that. But we could do a lot of push-ups and sit-ups. Mostly the biggest change for me was being screamed at and yelled at. And even, believe it or not, called by my last name. So I have a Swiss, my maiden name was Swiss. It's Foch. It's very hard to pronounce. Of course, they would mispronounce it. And my entire life, I'd been known as Sarah. And now, you know, all I am is Cadet Foch. And they take all your anything civilian away from you, and they kind of try to remake you. Now, the academy has since evolved, but at the time we did things like have to eat at attention, which is our neck back, and then you would take your fork and imagine trying to put peas on it, for example, and put it in your mouth, put the utensil down, then chew. So you obviously don't have a lot of time in these meals to eat. And we had all kinds of fourth class duties that could seem demeaning, like delivering upperclassmen's laundry, or picking up their old laundry, or delivering their mail. And any of those opportunities were opportunities to get hazed. And hazing can look like we had to memorize a lot of trivia. We called it plebe poop. So plebe comes from the Roman, the common people. Poop was all this history of things we had to know from heart, like trivia. So how many gallons are in Les Reservoir? What's the definition of leather? And that's like this long of a memorized text, and we had to know it verbatim. The definition of discipline, Schofield's definition of discipline, which was really hard for me because it was like a half a page of written words, every word. And they would know it so well that they would correct you. And so you could get flustered because they're asking you these questions while you're trying to do these duties. So those kind of things were very stressful and things that you'd never dreamed of that you would have to do. And there were times I cried. There were times, but I quickly learned you don't cry. You cry later. You don't let them know. And you learn that you can do more than you think you can do. You can memorize a lot in a second if you have to. And you begin to rely on your roommates. And your roommates helped you. They drill into you like you had to know the menu from breakfast, lunch, and dinner because they were required meals. And you needed to know what they were because they cared about their desserts, you know, and you had to know everything in there, how many days till Army beats the hell out of Navy, those kind of things. So it could be very stressful as a fourth classman.
And speaking of fourth, you were in the fourth class of women. Is that correct?
Right. And when I say fourth classman, so it's a reversed. So you start as a fourth classman or a freshman, third classman, second classman, and then first classman, we called ourselves firsty. So each of them have a designation. So you start off a plebe, yearling, cow, firstie. So for a woman, you know, whole year I was a cow.
That'll break down your humility.
Wow. Yeah.
That's right. Do the guys get the same names?
Yeah. If you're a second classman, you're a cow, you know. But then you belong to companies. And I was in Company H4. So there's four regiments in each. At the time, there were A through I companies in four different regiments. So I was in H4. We were go hogs.
So a hog and a cow. Nice.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. I read somewhere in your book that the upper class women were tough on you guys.
Some were. Girls. Yeah, some were much tougher than the guys. And you have to understand a little history here that the superintendent and commandant of cadets, when it was first being this idea of integrating the National Service Academies where you need a congressional nomination, all this was circulated in Congress, the superintendent and the commandant of cadets, as well as the Secretary of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, all testified against women attending these academies. And then it kept alive and they passed it into law. Gerald Ford signed it into law and they had less than 8 months to make this happen with a change they didn't believe in. So many of the decisions that they made very, very quickly would have lasting effect. So to fill that first class, they decided to be 10% of the Corps and each class starts with about 1,500 cadets, of which they graduate every year about 1,000. So there's always an attrition rate. But they said only the women will be 15%. So they start with 150. Well, for the first 10 years there were women at West Point, the graduation rate was about 50%. And my class, the class of 83, had the lowest graduation rate. And I mention this because to fill that first class, they had less than 8 months to make this happen. So they actually got enlisted soldiers. They went to high schools. And so some of the women, they were put through a much more difficult time because they were the first of the first, and many of them caught a chip on their shoulder. And some of them, in the one that I allude to, she was prior service. So she had a different mentality because even getting into the enlisted ranks at that time was rife with harassment and everything else. And one of the things they did for the first class of women is they hadn't thought this through. This is a very traditional place. And so they would have cadet hops, which were dances. And the women cadets showed up as well in trousers. And all of a sudden, the faculty is looking at them and realizing that these men and women are dancing together, where they traditionally had always bussed in women from local colleges wearing their nice little party dresses. And they still did that when I was there. And they were like, oh, no, the men and women cadets are dancing and they're in trousers. We're not going to make them into men. And so then they mandated for that first class that if you were a woman cadet and wanted to go to a hop and intended to dance, you must wear a skirt. And these women, some of them resented that so much. And I would too. I mean, they forced them to do makeup classes and they all kind of rebelled and, you know, took the lipstick all over their faces and stuff like that because they were forced to. They knew how to use makeup. And so some of them had this experience that made them, oh, you know, this place, if I have to have it that tough, then anybody behind me is going to have it.
Wait
tough.
A second. Military makeup class? Is this what you're saying?
Is right.
Because how fucking good can that really be? I mean,
they brought in women, like probably officers' wives, male officers' wives, to teach them makeup because they were getting such flack from all the graduates saying, you're making these women into men. Who knows what caused them to make that decision? Fortunately, by the time I got there, they had finally learned, you know, you need to do those things. You know, these are women. And I think for myself, as odd as this may sound, when you're forced into something that is so militant and so masculine, it brought out that I am true. I said, I'm a woman. I'm a woman first, and I'm not going to become a man. To be here, I'm going to become a woman. I am a woman. I am going to be feminine. There's going to be a feminine. So I didn't have trouble at times wearing the skirts that were issued, because I didn't have that hang up. But for some of those women, I could understand, you know, being forced to do something like that would create a lot of resentment. But I think
it's more of the issue, right? It's the principle of don't tell me how I'm going to dress or what makeup I'm going to wear.
Right.
Give me the choice.
Yeah. I mean, you can try to force a child to eat broccoli and they're not going to want to do it. It's all about wanting to have a human choice. And I guess in the military, there's sometimes less choice of options what you can wear when you're supposed to be in your military garb, right?
Right.
But still that removes the choice because they don't make the men choose. They just wear whatever, you know, they wear their pants.
Exactly.
So interesting. What would you say the most, I'm sure you ran into adversity and turbulence and all kinds of craziness. So what would you say was the most challenging moment during your time at West Point or in your military experience? And how did you overcome that?
I think it was the combination of leaving things that were familiar and then being put in situations that required you to dig really deep. So for me, there were physical challenges. I was gifted in that because, again, I had a mother that was very physically fit and I grew up with brothers and I was physically fit. So some of the women, for example, would come and they hadn't. I mean, you got to remember, I went in 1979, but some of the women, they weren't socialized long distance running or to do pull-ups or some of the things that you were required to do, lots of push-ups. And so they would fall out of runs. And then, of course, that would be used as another reason why women should not be there. They can't cut it, that kind of thing. I was blessed in that way. But even with my expertise, there were still such demanding things of us that it was insane. For example, in cadet basic training, toward the end, you go to something called Lake Frederick. It's the very end. And our squad leaders would build up this idea is it's the land of boodle. So boodle is a term that means cake and candy. So we could actually have access to something other than mess hall food, right? But it wasn't that way. It was cold. It was rainy. We were in pup tents. And we had to do something called the bayonet assault course. And all summer long, we practiced with our weapons, with bayonets on the outside, and we would practice these different slash and smash moves. And then we would build up and we would practice fighting among each other, but we do it with bugle sticks, which had cushions on the end, and we'd have to hit each other and do slash and smash series. And then the idea was we would go up with these bugle sticks up a very steep ravine and go over hurdles and then have a series of adversaries that were members, the rumor was, of the Army football team. Now, I'm 5'2", and at the time, I was 100 pounds, maybe even, not even 100 pounds. Now, you get scared when you know you're going to go against an Army football player in something that's very physical. And the night before it rained, and so our pup tent leaked, we had to sleep with our rifles, you know, that's what you do. And, you know, it just was miserable. And we're standing, waiting for our turn. There's a lot of standing and waiting. And I'm shivering and trying to come up with the courage to go up there. And one of our classmates, and this is kind of what would happen, spontaneously got up and kind of quoted a part of Patton's speech. So it kind of got us motivated, like, you know, you're a winner, you know, go up the mountain. And I run up, and you could just see the mud coming down, and I'm falling and hitting my knee on rocks. And I get to my first assailant, and he goes, can I do the slash and smash series? And I do, and he throws me on my back, and I end up in a pool of mud, right like that. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And he's screaming at me to get up. I jump up. I go, and with everything I have, I attack him again. He throws me on the mud, into the mud again. And at that point, I got mad because he reminded me of my big brother, Dave. Not that my brother Dave did that kind of stuff, but he was picking on me. And I got up and I got really angry, and I went at him with more than I ever had. I didn't know where the anger came from, but it did. And I didn't really subdue him, I wouldn't say, but he said, I think I surprised him, and he goes, all right, go on to the next. And so I went and did this. And before I knew it, I had gotten through it. I was shaking, you know, because I'd actually survived and I didn't have any broken bones. And those were the kind of things that I didn't think I had it within me, but I did have it within me. And when the going got tough, the tough got going. And then the rest, you would have another event that would be similar like that. And there were just so many different opportunities, not just physical, there could be academic. I mean, it's a very competitive place. I mean, most of the people that go there are valedictorians, salutatorians, top 10% of the class, very bright. And, you know, then you're in class with these people that can get a concept like that, you know, and you're taking differential equations and engineering and very difficult, trying classes. And sometimes you had to work together on projects. And so you had to learn to seek help when you didn't understand a subject, because it's a very rigorous place, because in addition to academics, which typically we take more credit hours than most college students do, like 18 and a half, something like that. Plus, you have all the military requirements. Plus, if you're an athlete like I was, then you're going to competitions. So it was a very intense place, and you often felt very overwhelmed. And the thing for a woman is we kept losing women. So there were fewer and fewer women that you could have any support from. And I mean, I went through a whole semester with no roommate at all. They had all left. And so there was this idea too of the loneliness. So the combination of the intensity of the place with some of the loneliness, still having to prove yourself every day, it was challenging.
So how does that translate, or how did that translate for you then going into the corporate world and getting through a different set of situations?
I think very well. You learn leadership, because there, it is a leadership institution, because you're going to go out in the Army and you're going to lead soldiers and you're going to have lots of responsibility at a young age. So often what you would find when you made that transition into the corporate world is people aren't necessarily accustomed to somebody who's had a breadth of experience like mine. I remember interviewing for a job with this guy. He's looking at my resume. He's looking at me. He's looking at resume, and he goes, I can't believe he asked this to this day. He says, how old are you anyway? You know, I was in my 30s at the time, but when you look at, you know, by the time I was 23, 24, I had 300 soldiers under my command. I had a lot of responsibility, but you kind of, when you've done it, you kind of figure I can do other things. So one of the frustrations veterans find when they get hired is they want to do more, but in corporate America, a lot of times we're stymied a bit. I think being an entrepreneur, as you ladies are, has really benefited me because pretty much if I want to go and accomplish something, I will figure out how to make that happen. I'm not afraid to ask for help. I'm not afraid to find somebody who's done what I'm looking to do and then learn from them and surround myself with good people so that I can figure out how to do it, such as writing a book. You know, I had to find a book coach. I had to find a publisher. And so you assemble a team, and that's a fundamental that you learned at the academy. You find the right people, and with the right people on board, then you can have success. So I think that's how I've taken many of the lessons that I learned at the academy.
I have to go back for a second, because the only thing I have been thinking about since you said slash and smash a few times was me and Gina up on the hill doing a slash and smash exercise. How good would that be?
And I remember
that sounds like fun.
The first time I had to attack another woman, it was odd because we're still not socialized to do that. And recently I was back at the academy for an event, and I was talking to the women, because when we attended, the men are required, all academic and physical education classes are graded. So if you fail them, you can be sent home. So men were required to take boxing and wrestling. Women were required to take self-defense, and now they're required to take boxing. And they were telling me about how difficult it was to go hit a woman in the face. I mean, they wear stuff, but you know, it was really hard. And I go, well, yeah, it was hard to attack a woman in, you know, self-defense, but now they're taking it a step further at the academy. So it was interesting. Yeah. It feels odd.
I am not slashing and smashing you in the mud, Rachel. It's not.
I thought I would throw it out happening. There, but okay, okay.
I know. Keith would probably enjoy that. Doug might enjoy that.
To be 100% honest, I'm fascinated. Like, I love military movies, and I love military books, and I love all sorts of, there's some great sales training books with military training, and including yours, obviously. But I also am a chicken, and I don't think I could hack it at all. Like, I have so much respect for any women that have military aspirations, because I'm totally a chicken. I will be in the kitchen hiding.
Especially at 5'2 and 100 pounds, that visual right there. I was
for
like,
sure.
Wow.
Hey, Warners, this is Gina Tremarco. And if you know Rachel and I, you know how much we love our beauty strategies, especially DermaVogue, where we both go to keep our faces looking younger and healthier. Every time someone says to me, something looks different about your face, I can't help but to tell them that the DermaVogue team, led by Dr. James Turk, has been offering the greater Myrtle Beach area the best in cosmetic and aesthetic dermatology since 2003. DermaVogue combines expert medical knowledge with cutting-edge technology, bringing their patients the most effective, flawless solutions to any skincare or cosmetic need. Some of the services to consider include Botox, skin peels, facials, Bio-T, and much more. I personally love and highly recommend their Botox and lip injections for making my face look younger and healthier, and for Bio-T for improving my energy, sleep, and weight control. At DermaVogue, they gauge you in the process of total body health to ensure your satisfaction with their comprehensive selection of the most up-to-date, non-invasive cosmetic dermatology and spa treatments. If you want to look and feel your best, DermaVogue can help you get there. Schedule your consultation today by calling 843-357-2444 or visit DermaVogue.com and tell them that the women your mother warned you about sent you.
I want to talk a little more about women in leadership. Mm-hmm. Because somewhere in your book, I think I saw something about women believing that they should be perfect.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And this is, you know, this is a constant ongoing issue for all women. So I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
I think where we were scrutinized as a minority at the Academy. And so one of the things that would happen, we had three required meals a day. These were so caloric because that's what, you know, a lot of the men would have higher metabolisms and they would weigh us at the Academy and then post our weight. And when you were a skinny little runner like me and it's ideal to be scrawny, I hated that, you know. And what would happen is some women would put on weight. Again, it's a very intense, you know, the cortisol levels were probably up. And so then they'd start with the female cadet jokes. For example, all female cadets had Hudson hips disease. West Point sits on the Hudson River in New York. And so their hips were expanding. Now, some were, but not all. And some were very diligent. You know, I was a long distance runner, so I'm out there running, you know, 7, 8, 10 miles a day or whatever. And that kind of stigma, that idea that you're going to be judged on how you look, affected me for years. And I can remember being in the Army and I married a classmate, my first husband, who ended up passing away some years ago. But we decided to have one baby in the military. I still call her my $8.19 baby, you know, because she was so inexpensive. Anyway, I had her.
Is that what it cost to have her?
Yes.
Okay.
And then my second daughter was born like 18 months later when we were civilians and we had insurance and she was well over 900. So it kind of tells you the difference there, you know. Anyway, they had just implemented, just before that, it had been 4 weeks of maternity leave, which if you all are mothers, you know, that isn't any time at all. And yep. They just had instituted 6 weeks. But I knew that at the end of 6 weeks, I had to take a physical fitness test and I had always maxed it. So I had this pressure on myself, I self-imposed to max it again, right after having a baby, which I did.
I was about to say, how'd that go? Awesome.
But then the same day I did that, I almost fainted because I had pushed myself. And I remember talking to my doctor and he's a Westpointer actually. And he looks at me, he says, Sarah, you just had a baby. Your body's not going to be back to normal for a year. Why are you doing this to yourself? And I said, it's because I know I'm going to be judged. I know I'm going to. And so some of it is self-imposed, but some of it, even having babies in the military has its, you know, skepticism, you know, there was even people that thought at the Academy, and then there would be some liaisons between male and female cadets, and a woman might get pregnant, she'd leave. Sometimes she came back, she might give the baby up for adoption. But I remember, so I also was a male officer after I graduated. So that means I helped people in my state go through the 2-year process it takes to be accepted at the Academy, working with high school students. And I went back for a training at West Point and I'm there and I couldn't believe this. And they're asking questions and this grad in front of me raises his hand and he asks, you know, so these women that get pregnant here and then they leave, aren't they just getting over? And I thought to myself, I had just had a few months before my second baby, 30 hours of labor. And it just came out of me. Now, in the past, I wouldn't have said anything because there was this kind of, you don't say those kind of things. And I said, have you ever had a baby? To the guy, are you kidding me? You know, you have no idea. Even if they gave that baby up for adoption, think how painful that would be. Or if they did the other choice, you know. And like it's somehow getting over to have a baby.
That's crazy.
What would your advice be for women who have this perfection infection?
I think you have to be kind to yourself. There's a season for everything. I believe that you can't do all things at one time. And a lot of us put this pressure on ourselves. I was also a single parent for a long time after my husband died. So that was just another level of learning how to reset expectations of myself and delegate. And some things you don't need to do, right? Who are you trying to do this for? The important thing is, you go back to your deep set values, and are your deep set values to push yourself to such an extreme you're not good for the people that are relying on you, your family, your friends and such. And so for me, particularly as a single parent, I got good at finding people to do things, and I was willing to pay them to do things that I couldn't do. Or I'd find, for example, someone to invest my savings and my retirement income, because that wasn't something that I wanted to spend the time learning deeply. And that was okay, as long as I found somebody that could do it, you know. And then pretty soon it became somebody do the lawn, teach your kids to do their own laundry. My kids learned to do laundry at very young ages, you know. And I simplifies dinners, you know. I'm not going to make some elaborate meal when we have too much going on elsewhere. So I think it's delegation. It's learning to take a step back, knowing that sometimes you need time for yourself. And I would schedule weekends away from my kids. I mean, I was their main provider, their mom and dad, you know, but I need to go get re-energized so I can be good for you. And I would do that as well.
That's a huge one. I think that a lot of moms and single moms as well, they get stuck in a pattern of feeling like they have to do everything and forgetting that it's okay to take time for yourself. Like I hereby stand by Sarah's idea of take a weekend away from the kids just for yourself. Such a great idea. Right. It's huge, because you're so right that there's new moms, there's seasoned moms, mm-hmm. that they're just so run down and exhausted. They can't quite function. And then they're snapping at everybody. Dads too. But I think moms, because we have that maternal instinct that we want to be the perfect mom, especially in today's world, and do all the things and the PTO and pick up the kids and do all of that. And then, you know, perfect lunches, and it's just totally not worth it. Right. I gave up the perfect lunches a long time ago because my kid wouldn't eat them anyway. So you want cookies? Great. Cookies for lunch. Perfect.
Done. Well, that is, my kids made their own lunches.
Ooh, yeah.
Good for you.
There's so much we can talk to you about, and we're running out of time. So I'm trying to like pick one more thing before we move on. Rachel, is there like anything that jumps out at you? Because there's like several things that I want
to. Yeah, no, I know I haven't had a chance to read the book, so I'd love to hear, you know, if you have any questions, Gina, for Sarah about the book or whatever, you go for it.
Well, you have several interesting chapters in the book. And of course, I'm always going to lean towards humor because it's a big part of my world.
Yes.
But you also have a section called No Whining.
Yep.
So I go back and forth between, maybe you can give us kind of an overview of each of those.
Sure. Well, what I intended with the No Whining chapter is to tell through a series of stories, which is really what I do in my keynotes and my speaking and in the book, is to tell stories that teach leadership principles, because I've been in learning and development for some years and leadership development, and people will remember things through stories. And so I tell a series of stories in No Whining, even relating to one of my personal heroes, a gentleman named Paul Galanti, who was a POW in Vietnam for 7.5 years of his life in the Hanoi Hilton. The most notorious of the places. But I then switched to talk about his wife. And while Paul was gone for 7.5 years, and they were a young married couple when he was shot down in his plane, she was incredibly shy. So shy that even though she'd gone to school to teach French, she was too embarrassed in front of a classroom. But then her husband's captured, and the years go by. And because they didn't have children, she became the chairwoman of the POWs Missing in Action for Southeast Vietnam. And in that capacity, she had opportunities to meet with people like President Nixon and Henry Kissinger and advocate to do something about bringing these POWs home or improving their conditions. And in the end, she was able to learn about where they were having the peace talks in Paris. She flew over and found out where they were in the conference room, entered that conference room, and in perfect French, with some expletives, told those Vietnamese, let our loved ones go, let us improve their conditions. And she started a letter campaign, thousands and thousands of letters. I mean, this is before the internet, you know, this had never been done in the history of the country, and kind of became somewhat of a rock star, you know. And it was interesting when he was eventually released and they were reunited, 7.5 years gone from your husband. And he said, when I left, she was like a kitten. When I came back, she was a lion, you know, and I just love that. And she went on and did some great things in her life, but then she got a very rare form of cancer that took her life very quickly. And I was at her funeral, and it was an unknown fact that until the very end that the speaker said, and her email address was nowhining@comcast.com. And I was like, that's it. You will be hit with crap that happens in life, but whining, there's no upside really, right? Mm-hmm. There's always something that you can do to move yourself forward in a situation. Does it suck at the time? Absolutely. But in taking a step forward and another step forward and another step forward, you're actually working your way around this incredible, difficult time. So, you know, she becomes, in my mind, one of the heroes. And, you know, until recently she was alive and I knew her very well. So that was one reason to write that chapter, because I think a lot of us get stuck when we have failure, when we have deep, deep loss, like I did, the loss of my first husband. But we need those people that we can look to, and we can become those people that other people will look to by embracing the no whining. And on the flip side, it's important to include humor in life, because humor has a way of elevating a team. It has a way of making us see life in perspective. And so I tell a series of hilarious stories that happened to me at West Point, you know, and I can't tell you in my keynotes, people love these stories, you know, and, you know, there's just so many ones. I'll just tell one really quick. A very challenging thing at the Academy is when you're a fourth classman, is the parades. They're very intimidating because everything is trying for perfection. You know, you dress right, dress, which means you're even with the person to your right, you're even with the person behind you. But when you march, obviously this creates opportunity for falling out of that. Your uniform has to be immaculate. You're inspected before. Everything you're doing, holding your weapon, is scrutinized by the upperclassmen around you. And when you're a plebe, they're really looking at you. And maybe because you're a woman, they're looking at you all the more. I'm on getting ready for a parade one afternoon as a plebe. I put on my parade pants and I realized the zipper, there's something wrong with it. Came back from the cleaners that way, but it has to be clean, has to be immaculate. So I put them on, go down. We start the parade and we're going through. And at the time we were doing something called a pass and review. A pass and review is when you're marching and you hold your weapon right here. And then the leader of the company, usually the company commander, he will do a command called eyes right. So you do it in beat to the music, eyes right. And we all turn our heads as we pass the dignitary. Now, this is Omar Bradley, famous 5-star general from World War II. And at the time, though, he was in his 80s in a wheelchair. So he's our candidate here. We're marching along. And as we, he says, pass. He says, I'm sorry, eyes right. I feel a gap of air go in my pants. That meant my zipper had zipped down somehow. And I'm thinking, oh, Omar, please do not look at me right now. You know? And there's not a whole lot I can do, right? Because my eyes are right. And you know, they were perfection. You can't make any movements within this parade. They could all see you. And so the air just keeps going. And then ready, front, and we keep marching. And then I have a decision to make. Well, holding your weapon like this and marching in time, it's very hard to make any kind of adjustment. We might have the rifle fall off your arm and things like that. So I just decided I can't do anything about it. I'd rather try to do the right thing and just keep us in line until we get back under the sally ports, where we as plebes have to wait for our upperclassmen to then inspect us, give us feedback on how bad we marched. And he's coming down the line and he sees me, he looks down, he's holding back a laugh. And he's like, Cadet Foch, do you need to make an adjustment? Yes, sir.
Yes.
And I get to zip up those pants. Yep. And so, yeah, it was pretty embarrassing. Yep.
Good choice, though. I think that was the right choice, is to leave it. Because honestly, as you were marching, probably nobody noticed.
Right. Except maybe Omar. I've always wondered, you know?
He's like, yeah, oh, that girl's got problems over there.
Yeah, make the choice and then laugh about it later. Right. I mean, right. That's pretty funny. This has been so fun with you. We have just a couple other questions to ask you that are a little more irreverent.
Yes. My favorite question, since this podcast, this is the podcast that makes everything sexy again, how would you define the word sexy?
I think it is embracing everything that you are, your flaws, your, you know, less than perfect body, and embracing and loving who you are and what your future can be. I think that's sexy.
Love it.
Totally sexy. I agree. So what's the best advice you've been given by another woman or a man?
I would say be truthful. I think it really was my parents. My parents were obviously fundamental, but a mentor that I had at the academy, at a very low point, I was very miserable, and he was my psychology professor. And I remember he allowed me to meet with him on a regular basis. And he said to me, "Sarah, the best thing that ever happened to West Point was the inclusion of women." And I was surprised, because it was like an unwritten rule. You never knew if some of those professors were against you being there. You wondered sometimes because they were so harsh. But then I knew where he stood. And he says, "Let me explain." He said, "When I went here, there were just men, and they didn't learn any social skills, many of them. They get out in the army and they make absolute fools of themselves." And he said, "You guys, you're changing this place from within." And that really inspired me to think about, no matter where I am, no matter what the situation is, I have a choice. And because I show up, I am making a difference. And I've kept that with me because I've worked in corporate environments that were very positive. There were a lot of negativity, a lot of infighting and, you know, backbiting, things like that. But because I choose integrity, I choose to be who I am, the best that I can be in that moment, I am making a difference. And I think that's what we all need to embrace. That we showing up have influence.
That is the quote, I think, of this podcast. Because I show up, I am making a difference.
Oh, so good.
That is really good. Sarah, where can people, what's the best way for people to get your book, first of all?
Well, if they'd like an autographed copy, they can email me. And my email is my name, basically sarah@sarahpoticha.com. That's Sarah without the H. I tell people I'm H-less. Sarah. Sarah Poticha is P-O-T-E-C-H-A.com. And I will do an autograph copy and send it to you. The other option is go on Amazon. Okay.
Excellent. And other ways for people to get a hold of you or to connect with you, is that the best way, is your email and your website is sarahpoticha.com.
Poticha. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Sarah, thanks again for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been such a pleasure. And it's time for us to wrap up. So thanks to all of our Warners for listening to this episode of Women Your Mother Warned You About, and to our sponsor, Dermavogue, who makes Rachel and I prettier than we already are. To connect with me directly or learn more about Pivot 10 results, you can find me on our website, womenyourmotherwarnedyouabout.com, or ginatremarco.com. And Rachel?
To connect with me, Rachel Pitts, I have rebranded. So everywhere on the internet, you can find me as the Singing Lender, since I'm now a lender that sings. So all my social media handles are the Singing Lender. And even you can get to my website through the Singing Lender, and you can find all of our social media links and connect with Keith Walters and find some great free downloads on our website at womenyourmotherwarnedyouabout.com.
So wait a second. Are you the Singing Lender or the lender that sings?
I am the Singing Lender because I'm the lender that that sings. Okay. And now every song that I hear, I rewrite for Mortgage. It's so weird.
Oh my gosh. Talk about humor. Okay. So that's our show today. If you have not had a chance to give us a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, please do that. We appreciate it. And remember, for the best relationships, keep it real, raw, and relevant.
Bye.
And maybe a little irreverent. Oops. Maybe a little irreverent.
I was irreverent trying to say bye to you soon.
That's okay, because we don't have to be perfect.
That's right.
Amen. Thanks for that, Sarah.
All right. Thank you all.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, Warners.
This really will get serious soon.
Yeah. It doesn't have to. I don't think anybody wants it to be serious.